He's on 24.
I think it's last year. And transportation for Wednesday, February 3rd. Welcome, everyone. We've got a number of items on the agenda, but the first thing we need to do is open a work session for committee rules. And Mr. Stembridge, I understand the rules that the rest of our committees have, and they're essentially the same rules as regular session with an exception on minority reports. Is that correct?
Yes, numbers 12 and 13. Number 12, the changes are minority reports. Members must give notice of intent to file before the adjournment of the committee, and though that is the same as last time. At least two present and descending members must sign. Number 13 says for the filing of the minority report, amendments must be requested within 1 hour following adjournment of the committee meeting. So that request has to go Legislative Council, and then amendments must be delivered to Committee Services, that would be me, 1 hour after the requester is notified that the amendment is ready from Legislative Council. So those are the only differences from your regular session rules.
Okay.
I move approval of the rules.
Senator Starr has moved adoption of the committee rules for the 2010 special session. Any discussion? Any objection? Okay, we have a number of things on our agenda today, and I'm just looking here who is in the audience. Okay, what I'll do is I'm going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 1019. This is kind of an omnibus bill that becomes more omnibus all the time, and turn it over to Mr. Stembridge to discuss just what the elements are in the bill and what the proposed amendments that we currently have for it.
Mr. Chairman, I have one-sentence summaries for each of the little parts that are in it. There's about 8 or 10 of those. I'll read as quickly as I can. Eliminates the required contribution for statewide multimodal study after December 31st, 2009. It revises the formula for distribution of heavy vehicle registration fees. It deletes the requirement that standards for medium-speed electrical vehicles be consistent with federal standards for such vehicles. It eliminates the requirement that funds derived from the Pacific Wonderland vehicle registration plate be used to establish and maintain an Oregon History Center in the state capitol. It requires signage for photo radar enforcement to include indication that school is in session in cases where the device is in a school zone not otherwise marked by flashing light. It clarifies that all-terrain vehicle seatbelt requirements apply only on public lands and private lands open to the general public for all-terrain vehicle recreation. It clarifies allowances under variance permits. It requires the Department of Transportation to make quarterly reports to the Legislative Revenue Officer and Legislative Committees on revenue raised by House Bill 2001 from the 2009 session. It declares an emergency, takes effect upon passage. You have the Dash 2 amendment, which allows rural airports to receive multimodal transportation funds for transportation projects completed or underway if the project received federal grants on or after July 1st, 2009. You also have the Dash 5 amendment, which adds the provision for DAS distribution of compressed natural gas. It authorizes the Travel Information Council to borrow money repayable solely out of the council's own resources. It clarifies the definition of speed limit applicable to requirement to move over to or slow down when passing roadside assistance vehicles. Members probably remember several of the bills that this omnibus bill applies to.
Thank you, Mr. Stembridge. I think first thing I'll ask is Senator Whitsitt to come forward. He has the Dash 2 amendment. Mr. Tindall will talk about it more later, but with the senator up here to talk about that. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Metzger, committee members. The problem we're trying to fix with the Dash 2 amendment.
Identify yourself for the record, please.
Senator Doug Whitsitt, District 28. And once again, the problem we're trying to fix with the Dash 2 amendment is that ODOT has determined that it is not authorized to consider a Connect Oregon 3 grant to an airport for a construction project for which the airport has already received an FAA grant. An example of this is like with the Klamath Falls Airport. They got an FAA grant for $1.6 million to repair the runway for the 173rd Fighter Wing and the Air National Guard. They received the grant and started the project before the Connect Oregon 3 grant procedure was underway. And so, as a result, ODOT determined that they would not be able to consider them for a grant. The entire thing that the Dash 2 amendment does is it provides the ODOT authority that they will consider those grant applications. The Klamath Airport is not the only airport. If you look on the third page of the handout I provided, there's 21 other airports that are in the same situation in Oregon, and they run from east to west and from north to south. So what we're asking you to do is just to provide ODOT authority to decide, to actually determine whether they want to provide a grant or not to those airports.
Okay. Is there questions for Senator Whitson? Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Mr. Kendall will comment on that, but they've been working on that, and so I think we'll hear that there's no issue there. But thank you for taking the time in. I'm going to recess the hearing on Senate Bill 1019. We'll get back to it in just a moment. And open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 1024. Mr. Stenbridge.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Senate Bill 1024 directs the Department of Transportation to develop highway access management system. It declares emergency taking effect upon passage. You have the Dash 1 amendment from Senator Johnson that establishes criteria for requiring a new approach permit issued by the Department of Transportation when there is a change in of use of a private approach. It requires ODOT to establish an access management system. And it makes a difference there on including rules that are less stringent for highway segments averaging 5,000 vehicles or fewer. And it requires ODOT to report the Legislative Assembly on the Highway Access Management System prior to January 2011.
All right. I'll ask Senator Johnson and ask Doug Kendall to come forward on this one, addressing the bill with the Dash 1.
Mr. Chair, with your indulgence, could I also ask the chair to allow Mark Whitlow to join me?
Sure.
He's been doing a lot of the drafting on this.
Absolutely.
Thank you for your courtesy. For the record, my name is Betsy Johnson. I'm the state senator from District 16. All of us have had complaints from our constituents about access management and the program. A significant part of the problem is that there don't appear to be objective standards to determine when a property owner is entitled to access to a state highway. Often the result is lengthy, protracted negotiations with ODOT, with rules that I think ODOT would agree are not uniformly applied throughout the five ODOT regions. This last fall, a bipartisan group of legislators had a meeting with ODOT and some concerned stakeholders, and a subsequent meeting with Director Garrett resulted in a plan to address these important issues. The idea was to take a small bite out of this problem in this special session and then develop a pathway to revamp the program in 2011. Mark Whitlow and Doug Tindall will fill you in on the details of the bill, but the important thing to know is that the Dash 1 amendments that you have before you were developed through a collaborative process, and there seems to be general agreement that this is the right approach that will eventually result in a solution that will allow property owners reasonable access to our highways while at the same time maintaining the functionality and safety of our highway system. I would like to thank Director Garrett for his acknowledgement of the problem and his willingness to help us work towards a satisfactory solution. Before I pass the mic to Mr. Whitlow, along the way this bill has picked up a substantial fiscal, and I think we're going to have the opportunity to have a little discussion about that. In my humble opinion, is an absurdly high fiscal for what we're trying to accomplish.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair and members of the committee.
Thank you. Let's go ahead and hear from the other panel before we have any questions.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mark Whitlow. I'm a land use attorney with Perkins Coie. I've practiced in the state since 1975. I'm here on behalf of the Retail Task Force, RTF, and the International Council of Shopping Centers, ICSC. And in that role, that representative role, I sat on the AMAC, Access Management Advisory Committee, that ODOT put together about a decade ago to come up with administrative rules for highway access management and permitting. We did a lot of work for a long time. It went on for about 3.5 years. 6 years after that, at this point, the private sector feels that the rule just isn't working as envisioned, and so we're taking a fresh shot at working with ODOT to get some traction here and to provide economic growth and development opportunities that the existing rule is thwarting, if you would. So we've not tried to accomplish everything under this bill in this special session. We've picked a few problems that are curative in the way that you've seen the language presented to you in this dash one. We've defined some key terms. We've spent some time doing that carefully. We picked the change of use rules as a target to clean up through this bill. Those rules have been intimidating, where businesses simply don't go forward to redevelop over fear of losing their existing highway approaches and driveways. So it does that. Part of the language also clarifies when public streets are part of that change. They're not, so it does that. And it sets into being a couple of other processes to go forward, again, in a collaborative way to, you know, address other things more holistically, including problems in smaller communities that have currently either low traffic volumes or they're not even projected to have growth. And so there's been an identified need to find things less stringent for those communities. Again, with the notion of allowing redevelopment, particularly inside urban growth boundaries, urban infill, which is consistent with state policy all over the place. So we'd urge your support. This doesn't do everything. I think we've committed to work together in a collaborative way without, and I think this is important, without creating another AMAC process, which was laborious. It went on too long. It tried too hard, perhaps. It cost too much, and it isn't necessary to have that done again to go forward and work together as we're doing, and this bill is a good example of that.
Thank you, Mr. Law. Mr. Kendall.
Chairman Metzger, members of the committee, Doug Tindall, Deputy Director for the Oregon Department of Transportation. Just quickly, by way of explanation about access management, ODOT has had the authority to control access onto the highway system for a number of years. It's important for safety reasons. It's important to keep traffic moving. As we've seen more and more congestion, it's become more and more important to focus on. That said, as Mr. Whitlow indicated, rules get written at a point in time, and times change, and we don't always take advantage of going back and making sure that the rule is delivering what is appropriate in terms of safety, in terms of moving traffic, and in terms of the balance of those two goals with economic development. And so the changes you see here are a start to bring this more in line with the environment as it exists today. I'm going to speak briefly to the large fiscal. This is one of those results from one of those sort of bureaucratic processes in terms of how you go about preparing a fiscal. And Section 2 of this bill says the Department of Transportation, in cooperation with stakeholders, shall develop a highway access management system based on objective standards. There's two key words here that cause us to go back and look at other places where we've developed systems and other places where we've done so in cooperation with stakeholders. So we base the fiscal on that sort of large collaborative process resulting in a well-defined system of some sort, maybe possibly a computer system. And that's where the costs come in. If, as the discussion has gone on, as Mark said, clearly getting to this bill, which you can, I think the indication was, as Mark said, and I believe maybe the intent, although not the words, but the intent is to have a cooperative process with some set of stakeholders to recommend further changes in legislation. Clearly, you've got a collaborative process with recommended changes to legislation, and I'll guarantee it didn't cost us $350,000. Now, we're probably going to look at more broadly than that, but if we can agree that that's what the goal is, to work as we have worked to generate this bill, to generate a bill for 2011, that we can go back and amend the fiscal. So that's all I want. I just want to say about the fiscal is that as long as we can get that on the record, that's the intent, that someone doesn't come back and say, you didn't do a full facilitated collaboration process, you didn't develop a full system. As long as we're clear on what the intent is, we can modify the fiscal. It's just the words that are in here today cause us to put that large fiscal on. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Tindall. I would have the first one just to, again, clarify that, because what I hear you saying is that as you read this, and I can understand reading it that way, that some may interpret that as going through a whole administrative rule rewriting process, which and maybe somebody would like that, and if we didn't do that. But your intent is to actually kind of do this offline and make recommendations later on that particular piece.
Do what we've done, thank you, Chairman Esker, to do what we've done to generate Senate Bill 1024-1.
Senator Johnson, you kind of look like you're on the drive in there.
No. I agree completely. This is not designed to do an elaborate AMAC kind of rule writing. It was never intended to be that.
Well, what I would, and then and I'll open this up to questions from the committee. I think what we'll do is, to be clarify that and not raise angst, trying to rush this out today, is to, whether it's a language change or a letter from counsel as to what, you know, the language does or doesn't have to mean that, or whatever you want to do, that would allow us to get an official fiscal that is different. Might be better to send the bill out Monday with that and take it to the floor that way. Would that be your desire?
Yes, in the main. I'm just hopeful that we can all come to the same degree of common mind that we came to in sitting down with Director Garrett. I think Director Garrett was very clear on what we were trying to accomplish here. The real idea is to try to migrate some of this access management out of rule and into statute. So there are clear and objective standards, and they are applied uniformly. And I don't want to trade off that migration out of a rule into statute to try to get rid of a fiscal that I think is absurd on its face. So that's yes and no is how I answer your question. I'd be happy to give it until Monday.
Senator, our intent would be to move it Monday. So, but this might give you a couple more days to take any angst away that you, if we wanted to have any more notes from fiscal or anything on it, and if that doesn't seem to be necessary, we'll just send it out anyway.
I don't think you're going to be very receptive to a table amendment, but I think we can fix this with the
not floor. Today, but we'll have it. We can have it ready to go on Monday. Okay, questions from the committee. Senator Berger.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I don't think there's a district or a county that hasn't run into this problem. It is just so broad in Oregon, and any time there's a change of use, then it becomes very complicated. And I guess that I would just say to Mr. Tindall, if we can just get to yes, with some common sense here, because that has been the problem, just as the physical today is a concern to Senator Johnson, every time we seem to have some business expansion, we run into these complex problems because that's the way it has to be done. And somehow we've got to get where we simplify things and get to yes more easily. So thank you for your testimony today.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Schrader.
Yes, I just wanted to make a comment that I agree with Senator Johnson about the size and scope of the fiscal, given what I read about what the real intent of this is. So I'm very hopeful that you can work something out, because I really don't think the intent was to have a fiscal that is that large. And when I went through the bill and looked at the fiscal, too, I was rather stunned by the overall cost. So I'd like to get that on record.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Craig Honeyman and Mike Eliason.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Craig Honeyman. I'm here today representing the League of Oregon Cities. Thank you for the opportunity to comment on Senate Bill 1024, the -1 amendment. While the League was not involved in the discussions that led to this legislation, we are generally supportive and of what we understand the intent of the legislation to be. Generally, cities do not seek legislation or regulation that limit or impede business development or redevelopment or their ability to manage the same. On the other hand, we acknowledge that regulation of access management is a tool that can be used to ensure that such development does not unduly affect or hamper mobility, compromise public safety, or does not generally comply with community development goals and objectives. Consistency and predictability are usually good things, and the creation of more objective access management standards proposed in 1024-1 is probably no exception. While the League does not oppose, as I said, Senate Bill 1024, the devil is always in the details, so we hope, and this is probably the most important part of my testimony, we hope that that cities are engaged going forward with ODOT and other stakeholders in the development of the new highway access management system based on objective standards that's contained in the bill. In short, the standards proposed by the bill seem reasonable in regards to private approaches. We are appreciative of the fact that they do not apply to public approaches, and we wholeheartedly support the fact that the legislation distinguishes between urban and rural roads and highways, and will work as part of any stakeholder group that's created to ensure that any future access management plan maintains that distinction. Thank you very much for allowing me to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Honeyman. Mr. Eliason.
Chair Metzger, members of the committee, my name is Mike Eliason with the Association of Oregon Counties. I just wanted to largely concur with what Mr. Honeyman said. The Association of Oregon Counties and county road officials were originally opposed to the original bill. However, the Dash 1 amendment is a substantial improvement. It's still being reviewed by some of our county traffic engineers, but most of the concerns that they had with the original bill have been taken care of. I will say that, as Mr. Honeyman said, that we'd like to be a part of the process going forward, because when you take what's in the rule, and in this case I'm putting in the statute, it does affect county roads as well. So with that, I would say that we don't have a position on the Dash 1, but it's a substantial improvement.
Thank you, sir. Questions for either of our guests?
Okay, thank you.
Thanks. So it'd be my intent to bring this back for work session on Monday, give a couple more days if there's other things that want to be done, and we'll take care of it then.
We'll carry it over.
Carry it over, please. Yeah, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1024, and we'll reopen the hearing on Senate Bill 1019. We've heard from Mr. Whitsitt, and so let's bring Mr. Tindall back up, along with Ms. Estep and Chris Warner.
This summer bill's in another committee, so. Summer bill's in another committee, so we're going back and forth.
Right.
Hi. Chris.
So, Mr. Tindall, you want to keep us off, or somebody else want to?
I can start for a second.
He has more in the bill.
I don't believe there's a fiscal on this bill. So I'd be glad to start. Chair Metzger, members of the committee, Doug Tindall, Deputy Director of the Oregon Department of Transportation. Senate Bill 1019, with the amendments, does a number of things. I'd be glad to try and answer questions on any part of it. With the help of these folks here, I'm going to just briefly cover the sections that ODOT identified that needed kind of cleanup changes from House Bill 2001. You heard from Senator Whitsitt about the changes to Connect Oregon in allowing, that allows a retroactive payment of monies that have already been expended. There's also a change in Connect Oregon 3 where a 2% requirement to be provided by the applicant was left in the statute. That 2% was in Connect Oregon 2 and was to finance a multimodal study. We believe the intention was to have that as 2% for Connect Oregon 2 and not to carry that through, and so one piece of this legislation removes that 2% requirement. for the applicant. The applicant will not have to provide that 2%. There was an oversight in the bill in terms of the distribution of funds. We've had agreement with our local partners to distribute funds 50% to the state, 30% to the counties, and 20% to the cities. And that particular distribution was left off of the heavy vehicle registration fees. And so, absent a change, those revenues would continue to be distributed approximately 60% to the state and 40% to the counties. We were recommending that change, or asking that that change be in place so that we can meet our commitment to the 50-30-20 split. There was a issue with the medium speed electric vehicle requirement and standards for medium speed electric vehicles. It referenced federal requirements. There are no federal requirements for or federal standards for medium speed vehicles, and so we're removing that so that the state can adopt standards ourselves. And finally, Section 11 amends a variance permit statute to reflect what has been a current and long-standing practice and is a bit unclear in current statute. And so we're just making sure that that current practice is able to be continued with clarity in the statute. Those are the four sections that I have. I'd be glad to answer any questions about those or try to answer any questions about other sections of the bill.
Well, when we get to the testimony and then any comments that you might have on those other sections would be valuable. Mr. Warner?
Great. Chair Metzger, members of the committee, for the record, Chris Warner, I'm the governor's transportation liaison with the department. I have with me Judith Estep from Daimler North America, their truck manufacturing facility on Swan Island. We bring you the dash...
Five
amendments. The Dash 5 amendments create something that we discovered, I think, in December. Daimler is trying to figure out a way to test some of their compressed natural gas vehicles in their Portland facility. One of the things that we discovered as we're going through that process is that there's no place to buy compressed natural gas on a retail level in the Portland area. So as luck would have it, there is a DAS facility on Swan Island very close to their facility, but they are prohibited from selling to the public. So this narrowly drafted amendment would allow DAS to sell fuel to Daimler in order for these purposes. I've checked with all the stakeholders in the energy distribution area, and they're fine with it. I've talked to Northwest Natural Gas and other folks, since there is not somebody that currently does it. We anticipate that if somebody actually does begin to distribute it on a retail level, then we would no longer need the DAS facility to do that, and they could use that, and that would be part of the rulemaking process DAS would go through. So I'd like to turn it over to Judith, and we've also brought some other folks from Daimler if there are any specific questions about the testing program we're going to do, and she can tell you a little bit about what Daimler's doing. Thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Metzger, committee members. My name is Judith Estep. I'm representing Daimler Trucks North America and here to answer questions about our compressed natural gas test program. Provided the testimony, but to summarize it for you, we are running a reliability growth program. We need access to compressed natural gas fuel. There are no public options, and the Swan Island facility is an ideal solution to support our research and development in the area of compressed natural gas.
Mr. Tunnell, do you have any comments on the other part of the Dash 5, the Travel Information Council?
I have nothing to talk about on that. We're fine with it. It just allows them to borrow money.
Oh, I love your simplicity. It just allows us to borrow money. Next issue. Questions from the committee?
So the Dash 5, would it allow DAS? I guess the question is there any other DAS facilities statewide that have compressed natural gas?
There is, Senator Starr. I have... Brian King from DAS, the fleet manager, is here, and he can answer those questions. I think there's a facility in Salem, but I'll let him answer. So
my question is, if that's the case, would this amendment open it up for the public across the board, anybody that has a natural gas vehicle or has a vehicle that's been that's bi-fuel, perhaps, access to DAS for compressed natural gas?
Chair Metzger, members of the committee, for the record, I am Brian King, fleet manager for statewide fleet administration for the Department of Administrative Services. To answer your question, Senator Stark, the amendment as written would allow that. However, we would seek in rule to limit that capacity strictly to those areas where it is not available in any other means, and most likely only for emergency purposes. Right now, there are no options for the public to buy natural gas fuel between Medford, Oregon, and Tacoma, Washington, on the I-5 corridor.
So my question then would be, so would you open it up for the public across the board so that they could purchase compressed natural gas at any of the DAS facilities?
Senator Metzger, Senator Starr, we don't have an intention to do that right now, but it does allow that right now within the bill as written.
So for me to support this, I need an affirmative response from you that DAS will open their facilities to the public, not just on Swan Island, but across the state. If you are an Oregonian that wants to purchase a natural gas vehicle or wants to do a conversion of their gasoline vehicle to a biofuel vehicle, that they would have access to the DAS facilities for compressed natural gas, because the reality is what you just said. There's no public facilities available.
Senator Stark, yes, if that is the intention, we would do that. The department does support the fostering of environmentally friendly fuels, of which compressed natural gas is. So we would allow that to happen for anyone who could, as long as there was no other commercial retail option for that fuel of compressed natural gas.
So it sounds like yes. An affirmative response. Thank
yes.
you.
I guess, Senator Metzger, Senator Starr, at least kind of my reading of it, it's not like the facility is staffed, so it's not like, is there somebody that's standing out at the facility? Okay, so like at the Portland facility, for instance, it's not like it's staffed, so it would be difficult, I think, in our initial iteration to actually have it, you know, for like sure. like a regular gas station.
I understand that.
I think as we go along, and perhaps if the market does develop and no one else does it, then I think that's something that could be, you know, definitely approached.
Mr. Warner, I'm certain that DAS in its infinite capabilities can come up with a system where they have access to the public, whether it's a card lock or some other kind of process. So I'm not concerned about that. So
okay.
As long as it's available to the public across the board, the reality is it's not retailly available today. It is a bridge fuel. It is a cleaner fuel than petroleum. It's something we ought to be encouraging.
Thank you.
Other questions? I would just prefer to get 103 octane uncorned fuel for my 1960 Impala at DAS. We could work that out. Okay. No other questions? Thank you. And Mr. Stambridge, to the best of your knowledge, are we still awaiting potentially other amendments, or have we pretty well heard from everything on 2019? We will. You know, has anybody approached you about, we found another mistake and we need to put it in here?
I think the most recent mistake has been found, and it's in the dash 5.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, we don't have the fiscal anyway.
We have the dash 2, which is separate from the dash 5.
Right. So what we'll do is we got to get a fiscal on this. Hopefully we'll fix that dash 5 and bring this back to work and send it down on Monday then. And is there anybody have any questions about anything at this point?
Let me clarify. The mistake was found in the dash 4. The dash 5 represents the
corrected
language.
All right. So all we need is all we need out of the fiscal then.
The dash 5 and the dash 2 are the current ones, yes.
Okay. All right. With that, we'll close the public hearing on 10-19. Hold that over for work session on Monday. All right. We have one last little bill. Put up a public hearing on Senate Bill 1050. Mr. Stembridge.
Mr. Chairman, members, Senate Bill 1050 requires that public bodies doing real property improvement and maintenance projects buy American. It requires that state and municipal funds appropriated for construction and maintenance use only iron, steel, manufactured goods produced in the United States. It does provide exceptions. The exceptions are for goods that are not produced in the United States in sufficient quantities or would increase costs by more than 25%.
Okay, well, let's begin by calling Ryan Tribbett and Bob Shipwreck up to kind of give us an overview of the bill. And I believe there's an amendment either in the works or you have, so we want to address that as well.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for bringing up this important piece of legislation today. I think I will be, for the record, my name is Ryan Trivett with the Ironworkers Local 29. I think I'll start off by talking a little bit about where this idea came from and why the bill is structured in the way that it was. Back when last year when the federal stimulus package passed, they included a provision that was called the Buy American provision. What we did was we took that language and identical language, copy-pasted it into a legislative concept that we submitted. The idea was, and we did that for a couple reasons. One, because we wanted to maintain consistency with a process that agencies were already using and implementing. We felt that was important for consistency, and we felt that was important for in terms of keeping the fiscal down. We did not want to create a separate organ process from the federal process. There were some errors in drafting, and we have made some significant concessions and compromise that will be addressed in the amendment. We do not have that amendment today. It has not come back from Legislative Council. But what that amendment does, three things. It includes a piece that was missing that inadvertently was not included that we had submitted as the legislative concept. That is one of the opt-out provisions. It adds a third opt-out provision. So essentially what this does with the amendment will create a dollar threshold at $750,000. That is a threshold that is used in other public contracting laws that that would kick in other Oregon laws like prevailing wage. So we use that to maintain that consistency. So for projects over $750,000 of public funds going to it, it would require the use of American-made materials as long as those materials were readily available in the quality and quantity that were necessary and did not dramatically increase the cost of the project by more than 25%. What the amendment will do will add a third opt-out provision, and it's the biggest one of them all. It says if a contracting agency does not deem it is in the public interest to abide by the Buy American as defined by the contracting agency, that they do not have to follow it. The third thing that the amendment does is it pushes the effective date back to July 1, 2011. That is the day that the next biennial budget kicks in. This is because the Legislative Fiscal Office was having a difficult time developing a fiscal impact statement because of all of the local government agencies and whatnot that needed to be contacted. And in the short time frame, we didn't want to see the bill get threatened to not pass based on LFO's inability to get a fiscal statement out in time. It also gives the contracting agencies enough time to develop this system in terms of how it affects from tax credits and abatements and the other things that are not direct appropriations. That is a slightly expanded scope, maybe some will say a larger expanded scope. But that is what the bill does. That is as far as we've been able to go. We've made significant compromise. Essentially what this will end up being, I mean, this is, we've compromised so far. This is practically resolution status now. This is a statement from the legislature that when a significant amount of taxpayer money is being used, that you would like to see them try to use American-made materials. As long as they're readily available in the quality and quantity, they won't dramatically increase the cost, and they believe it's in the public interest to do so.
Thank you, Mr. Let's go to Mr. Shipwreck.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Bob Shipwreck, Executive Secretary, Oregon Building Trades Council. My testimony today is limited to what is the problem that we're seeing. Things have changed in the last decade in the construction industry, and I'm just going to highlight some of the stuff that's going on out there and why I think this bill is really important. Before I get started, I would mention one other thing. It's an interesting statistic. China's economy right now is overheated because of their stimulus bill, which was about the same size as America's, only they had 100% requirement that anything you bought was made in China, and now they are trying to slow down the economy of their country. So making sure you buy locally really does increase jobs and the economy. This issue first came up to me when the Narrows Bridge was constructed outside of Tacoma. It was a big project, beautiful suspension bridge. Unfortunately, it was fabricated in Korea and shipped over here. So we lost all those metal jobs, all the fabrication was done by Koreans. This is when this first got on our radar screen. I was recently reading a national magazine called The Engineering News Record about the Bay Bridge in San Francisco. Their low bid was again Chinese steel for that bridge. I hope they got a real low bid on it, because the steel's going to have to be sent back to China, because when you start welding it, it does not come up to specifications. It is so poorly built or poorly made. I did confirm this with my counterpart in California, and that it has completely set this project back. We have a sheetrock company in Oregon. It's out right there in Rainier, Oregon. We make sheetrock in this state, yet a couple years ago, not so much in Oregon, but certainly in the southeast, we imported once again a Chinese sheetrock. This sheetrock is so toxic that it is corroding the copper wiring and copper plumbing in the houses that it was installed in. These houses are uninhabitable. We also make transformers in this state. Yet, over time, I've seen instances where, because we went with foreign transformers, I'm on the Energy Siting Council, and I asked one of the large wind developers why their project wasn't getting started. This was just recently. And they said the Romanian transformers weren't coming in, so they couldn't start their project. At a gas-fired power plant in northeast Oregon, not once but twice, their Turkish-made transformer failed when it was energized, costing the utility millions and millions of dollars. And in closing, I just wanted to say, when we had the bill up on the Senate side, Representative Schaffler said he did a tour of Bonneville Dam as they were rewinding and repairing the generators, and they had just put a new turbine on one of the generators. It was made in Brazil and was so out of round, it actually damaged the generator. We should be building this stuff in the United States, if at all possible. It's jobs and American businesses should be prospering when public works are constructed using public funds. There should be some level of interest shown that we can look for American-made products first. There's no excuse not to, and that's the intent of what we're trying to do here, and save our jobs, save our industries, and help our economy. That's all I had to say. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Shipwreck. And questions at the moment for either of our guests. Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Gentlemen, I guess the question for me is that just looking at it from a... Why doesn't this say by Oregon? I mean, and the reason I ask this is very specific, and I'm not trying to be flippant here.
No.
A lot of our businesses are dependent on trade with foreign countries that are in close proximity to our country, specifically British Columbia.
Mm-hmm.
And Korea, for that matter. In fact, I would say that we do a lot more trade with British Columbia and Korea than we would with New Jersey. Meaning, as far as the economy here, about them buying our products and us buying their products, we have a much closer connection with the Pacific Rim than we would with the East Coast of the United States, simply because of transportation, cheaper transportation. So it seems like to me that we would have much more of an allegiance to the British, you know, to the mm-hmm. people living in Vancouver or people living in Korea than we would perhaps living on somebody on the East Coast who's in the United States. So if we're really trying to help our economy, it seems like we would focus on Oregon, not the United States, or at least the Pacific Northwest and not the United States, because really a dollar shipped to Florida probably at this point in this economy is probably less well spent for Oregon than a dollar sent to British Columbia as far as how we trade with them. And I just want to get your kind of feedback on that, because I'm not sure that's... I think we're missing sort of...
Thank you for the question. It is a good question, Mr. Chair, Senator George. The simple answer is it would violate the Commerce Clause of the U.S. Constitution to say by Oregon. We wouldn't be allowed to do it. That would be set up like they would consider that a tariff in between states. And so that's strictly forbidden.
Mr. Chairman, if I could. This is kind of a little bit my problem. I mean, I don't have a really problem voting for the bill. Like you said, it's more of a statement. But, I mean, I worry about when we think about cutting off some of our trading partners in places like Canada, which is just across the border 300 miles to the north of us, or Korea, which is a $1,500 container taking our products and selling it in Korea, or Japan, who are buying our products out of Oregon. I get a little bit hesitant about thinking about shipping our dollars to Florida that we don't have a lot of trading, as much trading with. You see what I'm saying? I wonder sometimes if we're not sending the wrong message. We think buy American, but really, for the West Coast of the United States, our trading partners and our affluent trading partners tend not to be necessarily the 50 states as much as it is other trading partners in the Pacific Rim. And I just want to put that on the record because it makes me concerned that we kind of have this buy American when really what we're really talking about is buy regionally and buy with our trading partners. So if I can just put that on the record.
Okay. Other questions for the gentleman?
Mr. Chair, I'd just like to say I was very proud to sponsor this bill. I think that it is truly time that Americans started being supportive of the American worker. I think that we have we've watched in this country while we have some very, very large industries that are suffering and have been on the brink of bankruptcy. And I think that it's just time that we stop the way we think about things and try to help the people that need to be helped. And so I was very happy to sponsor it and had some great colleagues that are on this bill as well who have a real heart for American industry and business and in Oregon and in our country.
Mr. Chair, if I could, I appreciate the Senator's comment. And from where I sit and I see these things, we are losing some of our basic industries in this country, and we better start waking up to that fact. The Ruby Pipeline comes from the Rockies down to southern Oregon, where it connects with the large natural gas pipelines. It's about 600 miles long. We've got a steel pipe plant in Portland, North Portland. 600 miles of that pipeline is all coming from India. We've got Representative George's area, the steel mill out in McMinnville, products which are now being competed out of the foreign countries. So it's a wake-up call, I think, for this whole nation.
Thank you, Mr. Shipwreck. Okay, I'm going to have to bring you back up, Mr. Trivett, depending on what people's questions have. We have some other people signed up. Ralph Groner, Diane, Clyde.
Mr. Chair, I'll go ahead for the record. My name is Ralph Groner with AFSCME, and when I called my boss, Ken Allen, to find out our position on this particular issue, he said it's a no-brainer. So let me comment in a little different way in support of Senate Bill 1050. I'm not on top of construction or some of the issues as Senator George, who I respect very much, and all of you. However, I do read a lot, and I listen. And I can tell you that when we say India, when we say China, and North American free trade, and all of those issues, to me, the whole issue of free trade in a macroeconomic sense is becoming very frightening as of the news this morning on OPB, that China has now surpassed Japan as the second largest economy in the world and is heading in on America, and then again through the repercussions of all of that. And the fact is, it occurred to me just commonsensical when we were talking taxpayer dollars, I would assume if we sent this to a vote, at least in my county, then we're talking about taxpayer dollars being shipped to countries that do not reciprocate fairly with us. Let me give you several examples. One is China. They protect their industries, and they do not allow competition with our products coming in. Neither does India, and neither do those countries, and now they've grown and grown and grown, and they don't have the quality controls that that we have in this country. So I'm at a point, and my union, although public employees, my public employees, 1.6 million of them nationally and in this state, depend on people working in the construction trades, carpenters, any laborers, steel workers, timber workers, and we support job creation primarily because if we don't have job creation and people paying taxes, my city employees, my county employees, my state employees are not working. So I know this sounds somewhat outlandish probably to buy American and we're going to oversimplify it, but the truth is we're not in a fair system. We're losing our manufacturing base, and I know you all know that. You don't have to look very far around where our steel industry, where our aluminum industry, you just comment where they've gone. I think it's time that Oregon, who's been a leader on protecting our Oregon beaches, protect the bottle bill, and in the front of every other issue stands up and say, we're for American jobs, we're for bringing our manufacturing base back to America, whatever it takes. And quite frankly, if you're going to tie our hands from coming into your country with our products, I'm sorry. And frankly, America's in a major, major recession. And the fact is we have to overcome that by saying, Americans who pay tax dollars, would you support us in helping us put Americans back to work through resuscitating American industry and its manufacturing base? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Groner.
Go ahead.
Senator Metzger, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Diane Lancaster, and I'm the Chief Procurement Officer for the State Procurement Office at the Department of Administrative Services. Our job is to responsibly implement any policy that the legislature sees fit to pass. In this case, however, we believe there are some details that may create some unanticipated effects administratively. As you may know, the Public Procurement Code is divided into three chapters, and the one chapter that deals on construction, clearly this policy is pointing that way. However, there is another section that the bill does not recognize, and we believe that this would come under this policy decision, which is 279 Chapter B. Now, that gets to all types of goods that all state agencies and many local governments use, and the structural issues that we have are, for example, the bill does not define manufactured goods. Now, there is a broad definition of goods in the law, but it includes intellectual property and technology. So, in addition to all sorts of office furnishings and equipage and that type of thing, there are some other definitional problems. You know, appurtenance isn't defined, and for use in a structure isn't defined. So, what we're concerned about is that we would get caught up in a situation, for example, where technology may be embedded into a structure, and is that the intent of this policy? It's not clear to us. The other concern we have is that we do run a statewide price agreement, which over 500 state agencies and local government entities use. And again, we have carpeting, lighting, those types of things on that. And it would be good to know that the policy of the bill, you know, where it stands on this. So some lack of clarity for us and some concerns that there might be some unanticipated consequences of the policy decision in before your consideration. With that, I will entertain any questions that you have.
I think we'll have Clyde speak first and then have a couple questions.
Thank you.
Chair Metzger, members of the committee, for the record, Clyde Seike, Deputy Director for Central Services for the Oregon Department of Transportation. We've provided the committee with written testimony, but I'd just like to touch on a couple of high points of that testimony. First of all, I'd like to say that the department is very supportive of Buy America provisions. A lot of the federal money we receive comes with Buy America federal provisions attached, and so we've worked with these for a number of years, haven't found them particularly onerous, and have a great deal of experience with these types of provisions. That being said, there are a few issues and concerns we have about these bills, but I'd like to say that none of those concerns are insurmountable. They can all be worked through, and we have staff at the department who would be more than willing to work with the committee or anyone else to kind of clear those issues or concerns. First of all,
What we're concerned about is getting some clarity around what types of projects would be subject to the provisions of the bill. One suggestion we have is that we could include language that limits the Buy America provisions to public improvements. This change would more clearly define the type of projects that would be subject to the bill and would also have the added benefit of providing an exemption in case of emergencies like natural disasters in which we really have to move quickly to clear up a situation. We also feel that the provisions in the bill should be tied or linked to the federal Buy America rules and regulations to reduce confusion and potential conflicts that could arise if the state and federal requirements diverge. This would also avoid duplication and conflicts and would really provide clarity as to what requirements state and other entities would be subject to. So again, we do have some issues and concerns with the bill, and again, I would say that we feel that all of these could be worked through and are willing and ready to work with you to get those cleared up.
Thank you. Well, just on that same point, Clyde and Diane, you raised some very good points, and I do believe that with your assistance, they're not so complicated, especially since we're talking about restoring some boilerplate language that exists and makes a few clarifications that could ease some of those concerns in short order. Unfortunately, we just have short time anyway. But it doesn't seem to me that we're not exactly rule-making, but we're trying to set the umbrella language, and that could be very helpful. And I would ask that, because I think this is an important bill to move forward, if you would work with Mr. Trivett, Mr. Shiprack, in short order on how we might clarify some of those things, that would be very helpful.
Absolutely.
Questions from the committee? Senator George.
Thank you. With my great respect for Mr. Groner as a senior member of the lobby here and somebody who's, you know, like a grandfather to me myself.
With compliments like that, I don't know what
Keep going, Larry.
Now what is he going to say?
I want to kind of take issue a little bit with what you said, Ralph, about China. And I want to take this specifically because the importance of China as a market to Oregon. This fall, when we were trying to ship products to China, there was almost no containers coming from China into our ports. But the draw from China was so huge because their economy is so hot, trying to buy products from Oregon and from the West Coast. You could not get ocean containers in the United States to ship to China because the demand was so strong from the West Coast. China's economy is basically propping up our economy by buying our products right now. 2 years ago, you could almost ship things to China for free because they just wanted to get cans back to China. Now, it's almost the other way around. If you can find something shipped from China into the United States, you're happy because the expensive thing is shipping to China because the draw of the Chinese is so huge. In my one small little industry in this state, I estimate that the demand of the Chinese market here brings in just the additional money is somewhere around $40 million per year because the Chinese are buying our products. So every single year for the last 6 or 7 years, the Chinese have added 25 million Chinese to their middle class buying American goods. That's a country the equivalent the size of Canada. So I know that in the past we saw this rise of China and people are saying, oh, we're just buying things from them. Right now, they're buying an immense amount of goods from us. And in the industry I'm in, if it was not for the Chinese market, most of our producers would be bankrupt because they're buying so much product. So I appreciate the Buy American, and I think we should constantly be thinking about those kind of things. But I also want to just say that we have to be careful as a West Coast state that depends so much on trade with the Pacific Rim that we don't bash partners that are vital to our businesses here in the state of Oregon. And I just want to put that on the record because we go out of our way as Oregon state government to open up trade with China, to open up trade with the Pacific Rim, and we spend a lot of resources trying to do that because they buy from us. And there's some of our industries that are absolutely dependent on foreign trade. My business alone does about 95% export. If the export went away from my business, we would be out of business. So I want us to focus on the idea of buying American, but at the same time, remember, there's a lot of businesses in Oregon, being on the West Coast, that are absolutely 100% dependent on foreign buyers buying our goods. And I just want to make sure we don't get carried away going the other way.
Mr. Chair, I respect that, and I appreciate that intelligence coming into my brain, and I've got part of it. I would only respond a little bit, and I agree with part of what you said. But let me give you an example of a city I've lived in all my life, Oregon City. And let's take the mill, the paper mill in Oregon City, and let's find out why they're going bankrupt. And part of it is the president of the union, the owners own the mill, the employees. Bill sits on the board, and I said, why are you closing down? My father worked there for 40 years. My family all worked at Publishers. Now it's Blue Heron. I'm a mill rat. And the fact is, he said, Ralph, we recycle paper there. That's a big part of their industry, is recycling and getting it out and reselling the paper. They can no longer get the paper from people to recycle it because it goes to the Port of Portland and to China gets it on these vast, and you're correct, they buy it. But it also has had not just positive on, and I'm glad for that, and I'm not badgering China, my goodness. But the fact of the matter is reciprocity in my family I grew up with. If China is going to continue to give us the quality of products they have sent to this country that have been inferior and have had products that have made people and products of steel, products of importance for safety that have not met safety codes we have in America, and that's partially our fault. On the other hand, your business is thriving, and I want it to because I happen to love to eat your particular product myself. However, I would say that I am in agreement with those economists, and there's several sides to this, who argue that in a macro sense, America will never compete with China again if we can't bring back our manufacturing base of steel, all of the products. We've got to. And therefore, I stand up for this not only to help the shipwreck tradespeople, but America, and I mean that as sincerely as you do, let's be fair and trade with China, but they also have policies that eliminate 100% high-quality products coming in. We don't get the reciprocity in reverse, and I say let's buy American, let's manufacture American.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Berger.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I just want to remind the committee that this bill talks about public bodies, public subsidies. Mm-hmm. If I want to take my $750,000, I can do anything I want with it. But when you're talking about a public body, and I say that to you, Ms. Lancaster, it is a little hard for me to swallow that we're taking taxpayer money that Oregonians and Americans have given to you, and you're spending it on product that comes into this country that is inferior. So I think that you have to look at the bill in a different context than a private business doing business with their own money and having the freedom to spend that money the way they want to.
Senator
Starr. I have a question about the bill. I'm not sure who to ask for sure. Well, but in Section 2 sub E, where it says basically it lists A through E are forms of a public subsidy.
Mm-hmm.
So in sub E, it says any other form by means of which monies from taxpayers are used or by reason of which the state or subdivision of the state or the federal government or agency of the state does not, and I'll skip it, does not charge or collect monies for a public purpose that would otherwise be due. Would that include all of our public utilities if they're given access to the public right-of-way? So would the public utilities be subject to, because they're basically given access to this right-of-way, would utilities be subject to this bill?
I don't know if anybody can answer that, though. Is
there
anybody
not
can?
Charge.
No, sir.
We can find out. Nobody wants to comment.
Okay.
We'll find out.
Are you thinking of public
purpose? I can come up afterwards.
No, I'm talking about.
All right.
I'm talking about they're giving access to the right of way. They're not paying for it.
You'd like to comment? Okay, tomorrow.
They're not paying for it. So would they be subject to this Buy American? Because
they're renting.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Tom O'Connor, representing Oregon Municipal Electric Utilities Association. I was going to offer a few remarks later, but this is as good a time as any. Thank you. I guess we just have a couple questions that we'd like to work with the sponsors and the folks on this to clarify. One is the question that, for example, municipal utilities provide loans to homeowners to install energy-efficient equipment in their homes. Line 12, sub C makes reference to loans or loan guarantees. Those are done through ratepayer dollars, not tax dollars. So that's one clarification we'd like to understand whether that's impacted or not. The amendments probably take the $750,000 threshold may take care of that anyway. But we do have a overall question about whether we're talking taxpayer dollars here or is it go beyond that to, in our case, ratepayer dollars, which as a publicly owned entity, those are public dollars in some sense. So that's a clarification we want to try to work with the sponsors on. I'm not sure about the rights away question, to be honest with you.
Thank you for that. Good, Susan. Duke Shepherd, Bill Cluding.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Duke Shepherd with the Oregon AFL-CIO. Thank you to the committee members who sponsored this legislation, and I would just support Senator Berger's comments. This is about public money, and I think the expectation that our members have that if their tax dollars being put to work, that they should try to put Americans to work and support American business first as the first option. In terms of the DAS question, I think it's easy to look at this and overthink it. It's pretty clear it's about construction with public dollars, and we can over-define things, but the intent is pretty clear. Thank you.
Mr. Cluding.
Chair, Mr. Committee, for the record, Bill Cluding, Carpenters Industrial Council. You've heard from the experts, and hopefully you read my article I wrote a few months ago, Oregon Deserves Better Than a Jobless Recovery. What we've heard in here since last year was Oregon's in for a jobless recovery, and nobody's yet explained to me how that works. But, and Senator George, you made a good point, and I agree with you. But I think these trade agreements that we brought upon ourselves was supposed to be kind of like 50-50. We're going to help you if you help us. And you can look at our records, and we're not. We have a deficit each month. Horrible deficit. But let's look back what happened to Oregon. We've closed our aluminum plants. We've closed our major steel plants. We've closed our major manufacturing plants. And where are we today? We've lost tens and tens of thousands of high-paying jobs. And you've heard testimony. We've got to bring these jobs back somehow. We can't do it all at once for sure, but if business and labor sit down and we talk these things through, we could buy American. We could buy Oregon. Look at lumber. Last year alone, 2008, I'll back up one more year, imports from Canada for lumber, finished lumber, was 1.7 billion board feet. Meanwhile, our mills have folded up, dried up, disappeared. If we had these facilities today, yes, they would be limping. We'd be down to one shift, maybe every other week. But when this recession, depression, is over, these things would fire up 24 hours a day, pump the tax money back into the Oregon economy and put Oregon back on its feet. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cluding. Questions? Thank you. The only person to have signed up in direct opposition to Buy America is John Chandler of the Oregon Home Builders Association.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to have permission to deliver my testimony in Mandarin.
we accept.
Mr. Chairman, member of the committee, John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association, and there needs to be another slot on there. As the bill is written, we are opposed to it. We are not at all opposed to the principle behind it. And I look forward to seeing the amendments Mr. Tribbett mentioned. I do want to put on the record our concerns about the bill printed, because I think it's a tad overbroad. For example, it was already mentioned the tax credit for solar. For example, that would clearly be triggered there. Loan or loan guarantee would include such things as HUD underwriting a loan, FHA, which is the only way we can get houses sold right now is with FHA financing. Fannie and Freddie buy loans on the secondary market. That's a loan guarantee for the bank. That would probably trigger it. I don't think this is the intent, but the way it's written, those would be part of our concerns. And frankly, energy efficiency that's coming down from the federal government, some of the stuff this body has passed, the East bill that we passed in 2009 would probably trigger this. Again, I don't think it's the intention, but as we all know, drafting is very important. I look forward to the amendments. If those things are clarified, that would help immensely get support for the bill, I believe. As it is, it's just one more obstacle towards the housing recovery, certainly, and probably other forms of comeback as well. Similarly, paragraph E of Section 2, SDC credits would probably trigger that. And again, I hope these would get it straightened out, maybe the monetary threshold that was mentioned. I would encourage the sponsors of the bill, and I'll certainly work with them if asked, make sure this is congruent with the other public contracting law on the book, so we don't end up with a Buy American section that has language or concepts different from the general public contract. And public contracting law we've had on the books has worked pretty well. All of us know how it plays. If this factors into that, that'd probably be just fine. Manufactured goods, Mr. Chair and members, is a fairly broad term. Iron and steel, I get. Manufactured good, I'm not sure what that means. If it's a glue lam beam, and it was previously mentioned, we can't buy a lot of Oregon lumber because we don't let them cut Oregon trees. We buy Canadian lumber. That's a shame. It's a travesty. It's not right, but there you have it. Even when we start building houses again, a lot of the lumber we use comes from British Columbia because somehow cutting trees in the upper north reaches of the Columbia Basin is okay, but cutting them in the southern reaches is environmentally devastating. I've never figured that out, but then I didn't study science in school. And finally, Mr. Chair and members, I was sitting here listening to this bill, and I honestly and truly do not disagree, but I'm struck by the conflict between this legislation and other bills that this body is considering this session, in the 09 session, the 07 session, as far back as you want to go. I would defy you to think of a place we could open a steel mill in this state right now within a reasonable period of time at a reasonable dollar amount. Look at the Portland Harbor, which used to be the absolute beating heart of this state, and we are tied up in Superfund litigation, we are tied up in environmental setbacks, we are tied up in residential and in commercial encroachment into the working harbor, where one of the places that used to provide jobs for thousands of Oregonians is now being turned into condos. Now, we build the condos, that may be a good idea, but we've lost the industrial base. And we've watched it. We've waved goodbye to it. We've passed bill after bill after policy after law after tax after fee after environmental restriction, and we have made sure absolutely positively that we strangled off our industrial capacity in this country and in the state. And I am sorry for being passionate, but you are grabbing the wrong end of the stick here.
Mm-hmm.
Buy American, absolutely right. Let's make sure we can build American first. And, folks, we have absolutely torched our ability to do that. We buy imported concrete. You know how heavy it is to ship concrete? We buy concrete, and it's lousy concrete. We buy it from overseas because we can't make it here. We can't make it here because of regulations, restrictions, and other obstacles. Same thing with Chinese drywall. Thank God we haven't had that here. Why do we buy drywall from China? With all of its poisons and toxins, we buy it from China because we can't make it in the States. And those are all policies that bodies like this, legislatures like this, the federal government has made absolutely sure. And I bless your hearts for this bill. I appreciate it. But make the other pieces happen, too. Because this by itself, we can't just do demand side. You got to do supply side. And the demand side is important. The supply side, I would submit, is much more so. End of sermon. Thank you for your time. I'm glad to take questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chandler, for your comments.
Yes.
Any other?
Mr. Chandler gave the sermon, so I didn't have to.
All right. Any others?
Okay,
Chairman.
Thank you, sir. Yes, Senator.
I just want to follow up. I think about the mills that were east of the mountains, and almost every one of our mills, our sawmills, or family wage jobs east of the mountains, were shut down not because of a lack of demand, but because of the fact that they could not cut timber east of the mountains in the state of Oregon. And I just find it to be a tragedy. I mean, we have long before we had this recession, and it was aptly put, depression, we were losing our industrial base in this state at the peak of the economy. And a lot of it had nothing to do with trade policy or anything else. It had to do with the fact that this state has been fairly hostile to the natural resource and blue-collar work base in this state, like cutting off supply of timber and making it more difficult to create concrete in near the Idaho border and these other places. And those are the kind of things that we do this bill. It's important to do this bill. There's no doubt about it. But we also have to think about everything else we do, and I think Mr. Chandler was exactly right. And I think about all those thousands of people who lost their jobs east of the Cascades in sawmills simply because of the fact of decisions made here in Washington, D.C. to cut off the supply. And so then we start importing from Canada. And it's just wrong. So both sides are important.
Thank you. Okay. Any other comments? Thank you all. Mr. Chairman, I think you've heard a number of things in terms of narrowing this, and people are willing to help to make it at least clear what the intent is. I think that would be very valuable. I do appreciate the comments from everyone. I would agree that the supply side is a critical part. You can create all kinds of things for purchasing, but if you can't do it, and I think even beyond this body, certainly, you know, that is a huge issue where, you know, we have regulations that are good. They are important. But if they inhibit us from providing supply from somewhere else, and once those regulations don't apply, I don't know in the global sense that we've really achieved anything particularly good. So, and I know there's a lot of people who are very concerned about trying to make uniform standards so that if we're going to not get concrete or from Turkey because it's dirty, that we just don't bring in dirty concrete from China and feel like we've done something good. So I understand those issues, and it's something that needs a lot of work. We have to be able to build steel, and we have to be able to build electricity. We have to be able to provide power. We have to be able to find the ways in which we can compete, and we can't do that if we don't have those manufacturing facilities around. Because if we just close our eyes and bring something in because it's competitive without knowing how that was produced or what it contributed to the planet, then we really haven't achieved anything but a feel-good deal. So it's a broad issue, and we know that, and I appreciate your comments. Colleagues, we'll bring this bill back, and we'll try to get this on next week as well. Mr. Stembridge, I'll close the public hearing first on 1050. We meet again on Monday, is that correct?
Yes, you meet on Monday. This was your first meeting. Wednesday will be your last meeting for Senate bills today. So, yes.
So, they just have to be scheduled, right?
Mm-hmm.
Tomorrow
Wednesday is our last meeting.
Our last meeting to move bills out.
Last meeting.
It has to be scheduled by tomorrow, but Wednesday is our last day to do it.
Last day to move them out. Okay.
Okay. With that, we're adjourned.
Yeah, and I'm coming.